Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. You may have heard about slow food, the movement to get us eating in a less industrialized and more sustainable way. Well, those values just might be able to help fix our economy, too. Slow money today on the show. And are your neighbors foisting homegrown tomatoes on you? What to do with all of them? Plus, women farmers, just how many of them are out there? But first, let's see what both genders of farmers are bringing to the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have an excellent insider's tip, as usual, here at the market on a very interesting form of fruit. And fortunately, we're being informed today by David Karp. He's an eminent fruit researcher. And David, once again, you're very excited about something that no one else would have noticed other than you. Can you tell us about it?
Well, lots of people actually have noticed it, but you've got to be a noticer because it's in the back corner of Tenorelli Orchard's stand, and it's sort of reserved for the cognoscenti of the enthusiasts. It's the subject of a veritable cult. And what is it? It is an Indian blood freestone peach, which originated in the mid-19th century at John M. Ives' farm in Salem, Massachusetts. And it was believed to have been derived from one of the old blood peaches. There were dozens of cultivars of this that were grown in Europe, typically in vineyards, and it was thought by people at the time that somehow the red from the grapes participated in the peach and infiltrated the flesh. Now, let's just describe this, because it's very unique looking. It's got thick fuzz, almost like a mouse in some cases, which is very much selected against by modern breeders. Greenish-white sort of mottled with red.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
Smell.
Okay, it smells like a peach.
It's intensely aromatic.
Yes.
When these get ripe, you can smell them from 10 feet away, and the fruit flies can, too. It's sort of a creamy color with a little bit of red next to the stone.
Right.
Now, the classic Indian blood free is pigmented all the way through with anthocyanins, which are the compound that's responsible for the pigmentation in cherries and apple skins and a lot of red flowers and an awful lot of them, blood oranges, for example. But there's relatively little of this. Yes, there's some sort of light wisps of red infiltrating the flesh.
Right.
So what happened? Because when the trees were young, according to John Tannarelli, they produced fruits that were red all the way through. Now, they're a very good peach. They're good balance of sweetness and acidity, very aromatic, slightly mealy, I would say, but about as good as the peach gets this late in the season.
Okay. So where did the red go?
Exactly. Was there some pomological vampire that came along and sucked the anthocyanins out? My friend and partner Andy Mariani of Andy's Orchard in Morgan Hill, who has grown these for many years, suggested it might be horticultural practices, because when he neglects his Indian blood free, they're completely red all the way through, and yet when he gives them good fertilization and thins them properly and irrigates, they tend to lose much of their pigmentation.
Oh, that's so interesting.
They used to have them, but they've lost it somehow. It's a big mystery.
And these are available at the Wednesday Santa Monica and at the Saturday Torrance, correct? The two markets?
That's right. And Yinks has them at Hollywood Sunday.
And you can get them Hollywood Sunday as well. And you're asking for what, the Indian blood red peach?
Indian blood freestone peach.
Okay. Thank you, David.
You're welcome, Laura.
We'd like to make use out of everything here at the market, of course, and we are visiting now with Amelia Saltzman, who is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. And if anybody can make use out of everything at the market, it's Amelia. And Amelia, carrots are here. You have got a recipe with carrots. I'd love to have you share. And go ahead and tell us about that.
It's true. I just all of a sudden, oh my goodness, look at these fat Chardonnay carrots at Jerry Rudess's stand. I mean, they just called right out to me. The other thing, Zhang Pao He has been bringing fresh, juicy, succulent ginger with the greens attached. So I thought, carrots, ginger. And a perfect time of the year because, as you know, it's the Jewish high holidays and carrots and all sweet things are really a great part of the festival foods. So I came up with the simplest carrot soup. So here's what I did. I sautéed a chopped onion in a tablespoon or two of butter. I chopped up the knob of ginger, and I just peeled it.
So describe the ginger.
Well, you know, what we're used to seeing are these sort of desiccated, dry, very woody things, and that is not at all what we're seeing now. This is fresh, pulled out of the ground, and juicy looking. Moist, very thin skin. I would describe this as young ginger. And the texture I would describe as almost more like a very juicy jicama. Okay, no fiber whatsoever. And with the stalk, the farmer told me that you can use the tenderest of the leaves, not the ones that are starting to dry out. But I threw in a few leaves into this soup, and I'm very excited about the ginger. I've been throwing
you
it in everywhere.
Never see it. Like
no,
this.
It's such a gift to the market. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it is. So, saute this onion. Throw in the peeled, finely chopped ginger and the peeled, chopped up carrots. And saute them till they soften. I happen to have a couple of leftover roasted potatoes, so I just peeled those and threw them in.
So these are pre-cooked?
They were in my case, but if you didn't have pre-cooked potatoes, just buy a couple of extra little potatoes. You're not making a potato soup. You just want to smooth out the texture.
Chop and saute those with the vegetables.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Great.
And some stock or some water, vegetable, chicken stock, either one would be great. And then if you've got some of those green leaves, put them in and give it a try. See what happens. The taste of the carrots, the taste of the ginger, which is a classic preparation, was so fresh and lively because of how everything had been grown and harvested. You really didn't need anything more.
All right, Amelia. Well, thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman, and she was once again sharing something fresh and inspirational here at the market, including carrots and this really nice fresh ginger. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Laura Avery writes a weekly blog post on the Good Food blog. You can see her pictures and read the post at kcrw.com/goodfood. And check out the video that we shoot each week. We go to the farmer's market, meet with growers and chefs. Watch it on the Good Food video app if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch. Or you can watch the video on our site, kcrw.com/goodfood. One thing that farmers market shoppers are buying in abundance right now are tomatoes.
I'm buying heirloom tomatoes, a variety of them, some basic red, some brandywine. I'm going to make a ratatouille. I like to use a variety of tomatoes. I like to use a lot of onions and garlic and make sure I don't cook it too quickly so that it stays sweet. I'm not really big on green peppers, but I'm going to put in red peppers and maybe there's some purple and some orange ones, make it really colorful.
Yellow cherry tomatoes. I just walk along here and I pop them in my mouth.
I like personally the yellow, red, and orange, and not just red tomatoes. We're going to make salsa. We're going to eat big tomato slabs with buffalo cheese on them and fresh basil, and also make tomato sauce and tomato soup. My wife makes the best tomato soup around.
I bought the organic heirlooms. They'll either go in salad or they'll get sliced with mozzarella cheese, and I got some fresh basil and a little salt and pepper and maybe a little balsamic vinegar.
Heirloom is just the key what I'm looking for, something that's just fresh and organic, and I will be making a tomato and baby beet salad with them.
These are the heirlooms, and I bought one because I'm only visiting here, and I'm leaving tomorrow, and I just love them. I'm just going to slice it and put salad dressing on it, with a little basil maybe.
Those were shoppers at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week. Brian Yarvin wrote a book called Too Many Tomatoes. I asked him how he likes to eat those love apples.
I've put some salt and pepper on them, of course. I think that those are the forgotten, wonderful, miracle seasonings. But I like them in salads. I like them chopped up. I think that it's possible to do too much to a raw tomato. I don't think raw tomatoes need 10 other ingredients or anything other than salt and pepper most of the time.
Yeah, I agree with you, I have to say. You know, it's funny because whenever I'm in Italy, particularly this time of year in September, it's, you know, everywhere you go, you see every woman over a certain age embroiled in bottling tons of either whole tomatoes or sauce. And here often tomato sauce gets a bad rap.
In my wife's family, which is Piemontese, there's a big dichotomy between those who can, who are actually so old now they're no longer canning, and those who freeze, which seems to be the current preferred method. And I think freezing gets a bad rap here too, and I don't know why. I think that the Italians have it right in this case.
What are some ways that, what are some of your favorite ways to preserve the Bounty?
Well, it's my wife and I in a condo in New Jersey. And in New Jersey, we have a stupendous Bounty of tomatoes this time of year. And what we want to do, rather than make a passata the way a traditional Italian family would, we would want to cook stews and sauces with those tomatoes and freeze them already prepared as recipes so we can defrost them later in the year without having to take another cooking step.
But what is passata? Describe it.
Passata is stewed ground tomato that has had some of the water removed and some of the raw flavor of the tomato removed so it can be canned or frozen easily.
Yeah, I really love to do that too. And I think a lot of people forget that in the course of a year, you in fact do end up using tomatoes for so many more things than just a pasta sauce.
Well, I hardly ever make tomato pasta sauce except in batches to freeze or for local events, you know, potluck dinners or church suppers or what have you. I find that I want to make other kinds of tomato dishes. I want a Hungarian tomato soup, and I want roasted tomatoes, oven-roasted tomatoes, as much as I want, say, chicken cacciatore.
So what is in a Hungarian tomato soup?
That's a broth. That would be where you would take the whole peeled tomatoes, you would boil them in water, or simmer them in water, actually, until you had a broth, as if you were boiling bones for stew. And then you would strain it like a broth. I find it to be a really kind of refreshing soup base, or just I like it by itself. I'm not one for complex, rich soups.
You have recipes from so many different cultures. Is there a country you can think of that doesn't use tomato in its cuisine?
No, I can't. I can think of countries where tomatoes are not a favorite. Like, for example, in China, I think more people eat tomato on pizza than they do in Chinese cuisine, but there are recipes, especially in Guangdong and Hong Kong, where people eat tomatoes in stir fries and they like them.
What about India?
Well, I think that in many parts of India, and for many Indian cooks, a curry isn't a curry without tomato, or at least tomato base. And I have actually made a tomato curry for the book, and I make curries with tomato all the time. It's an essential ingredient, and it can be either fresh or canned diced tomato. The tomato in any form works really well in a curry.
Now, what about desserts?
Well, desserts come in two separate categories. There are the people, especially older Koreans, who seem to just take some sugar and sprinkle it on a wedge of tomato or half a tomato, and that becomes a dessert. And I think that's perfectly fine. That's a habit I've picked up myself. But there are also composed desserts. I really got into the roast tomatoes with 12 flavors that Alain Passard did at his Paris restaurant Arpège. Now, I've never eaten at Arpège. It's totally out of the price range of the typical cookbook writer. But the recipe is on his website, and I have first recreated it, and then I created my own simplified version. And that has become a very successful dessert. In my house, it's very easy. And I hate to say this, but you can make it with those out-of-season stem tomatoes that they sell in much of the rest of the country, like in January and February.
What are some of the ingredients in the dish? I've actually made it before myself, the Arpège version, for a special all tomato dinner I did once, and it was so much fun to do. A lot of work. I'm curious to know about your simplified version. Let me go ahead and read some of the ingredients. So it's pear, fresh apple, fresh pineapple, orange juice, walnuts, almonds, pistachios, raisins, orange zest, lemon zest, and fresh mint.
In my version, to simplify it, I mix them together in a syrup rather than candying them individually and stuffing them in the tomato. And it works out very well. It becomes, once you get all those fruits chopped, it becomes a pretty easy dessert.
And absolutely delicious and very surprising to people.
Oh, yes. It's a wonderful surprise. And even I, and I've made it a bunch of times, I'm still surprised that it's good, and I'm delighted that it's good.
Too Many Tomatoes is the book by Brian Yarvin. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for tomato recipes and share yours with us, too. Click on Latest Show and leave a comment or advice. One thing that most kids won't eat is a raw tomato. Boil them down and strain them into a sauce or stick them in ketchup, and it's a whole different story. I'm doing a really fun event for kids next Saturday at the Westfield Topanga Shopping Center in Canoga Park. I'm looking for the world's pickiest eater. I'll have lots of taste samples like tomatoes and basil, Nutella and bananas that they can try in bruschetta. They'll rate and share their tasting notes with their parents. Bring me your pickiest eater, and let's see if we can't expose them to some new flavors. It should be a lot of fun. It's Saturday, September 26th from 2 to 4 p.m. on Topanga Canyon Boulevard in Canoga Park. Frank Bruni, former New York Times restaurant critic, never met a food he didn't like. If you listened to the show last week, we talked about his obsession with food and his struggle with his weight. Next, I talked to him about being a critic for the New York Times and why it was like being in the Witness Protection Program. That's coming up next on Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Frank Bruni recently announced that he would be stepping down as New York Times food critic. The announcement was nearly simultaneous with the release of his brutally revelatory memoir, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater. A lot of people, when they think about being a food critic, they immediately go into the spy mode that they think one has to take on. And especially in this age of the internet, it's even more difficult than ever to keep one's likeness out of the hands of restaurateurs. To what length did you have to go to disguise your appearance when you dined out?
I seldom use disguises per se, because the few times I did try that, I found myself feeling so awkward in them. In my limited experience with them, if a restaurateur was someone who was going to be able to recognize you, they were going to recognize that you were just yourself disguised, and then you'd feel doubly silly. But I took enormous pains to make sure that a restaurant didn't have any idea that I was going to be showing up, because you didn't want them to staff up extra. You didn't want them to kind of make sure they had a certain lineup of personnel just because you were coming in. So, you know, I used made-up phone numbers that changed every single day when I made reservations. I used made-up names. When I paid at the end of a meal, in case they hadn't recognized me, I used pseudonymous credit cards that the Times had arranged with American Express to get for me. So it really was a whole covert operation, sort of like, you know, the Bourne Identity meets Julie and Julia.
I love that. I love that the Times and American Express collaborated to give you, it's like having the passport, right, with different different passports.
One of the things I would do, because you would get recognized in a restaurant, is I would hand the fake credit card under the table to one of my guests so that there wasn't this absurdity of this man whom they knew to be Frank Bruni handing them a credit card that said Joseph Mazzone, which was one of the names. And I learned as I went along that you could be better at this, because the first batch of fake credit cards I got were all men's names. And there were evenings when I was dining with three women, and I couldn't exactly ask one of them to sign as Joseph or Jeff or Greg, because it wasn't going to fly. So in later years, it was always PJ or Robin or Pat, you know, those sort of like gender neutral names.
So let's talk about dining out not alone. You always, or I would imagine most frequently, brought a table full of people so that you could taste more dishes. What was the experience like having to bring people, but then have to try and control the experience so you could eat as much of the food as you could?
It was pretty tough, because you're asking people to sort of master cognitive dissonance of a sort. You're telling them, I'm taking you out to dinner. We're gonna go to this restaurant. And they're thinking, oh, fun. And then you sit down and you're telling them, no salmon. We tried that last time. You know, your steak is medium rare. I don't care if you like it medium well. You can't judge a piece of beef by medium well. And there's a real tension at the table between people's understandable, inevitable impulse to enjoy themselves and your need to have them play by a very specific set of rules in the service of the review you're writing.
So, for example, you would parcel out who was going to get what, and they were told that they could only eat, like let's say there were four people, they could only eat a quarter of it because everything was going to be passed around.
Yeah, everything would get passed around sort of Lazy Susan style, the goal being for me to try everything, but, you know, everybody would try everything equally. And that, again, you know, you're fighting against human nature because when somebody has something delicious in front of them, they want to consume as much of it as possible. So I spent no small measure of my reviewing life playing portion cop, you know, like looking at the other side of the table and say, you know, that lamb's getting really, you know, it's almost all gone. Remember, I need to try it. And it violated every generous host bone in my body, but you have to do it.
How did you manage to regulate your food consumption? You were eating out, I would imagine, seven nights a week and tasting nearly everything on the menu and trying to keep your weight down. Did you have certain strategies?
I regulated it really in just a couple of small ways. I mean, one was I exercised constantly. I accepted the fact that if I was not ever going to have the ability to diet, which I wasn't, because there was no, you know, portion of the nutrition spectrum I could ever cut out and do the job I needed to do at a restaurant, I accepted the fact that I needed to exercise seriously and regularly, and I never let that fall by the wayside. But I also, when I sat down to a meal, I partly because I was in a tasting mode, I was careful not to finish something just for the sake of finishing it or to continue eating when I was plenty full, because I knew, again, that I had to eat a certain amount and couldn't fall below it. So my main protection was not to, on the flip side, go so far over the amount that a normal person would eat that that I would land in trouble.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Frank Bruni recently stepped down as the New York Times restaurant critic. He has a great book out now about his struggles with food. It's called Born Round. The first part of my interview with Frank aired on last week's show. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to listen. Restaurant critics don't ever have to worry about the psychological warfare involved in picking up the tab at dinner. Like, what's the proper way to pick up the check when your friends recently lost their job? Is there a nice way to do it without reminding them of their misfortune? We asked Chow.com etiquette expert Helena Eichlund how to handle this. Hi, Helena.
Hi.
So this is a tough one because I have to say that I tend to be one that's kind of free with picking up the tab, and I may not be as sensitive as I could be, I think, sometimes.
Well, I think there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And the wrong way to do it, and I'm sure you don't do this, is to just sort of throw down your credit card and be like, hey, I'm getting this because you're out of work. But the right way to do it is to just not make a big deal out of it and just downplay it. Just be like, hey, my treat. And then if the other person protests, then just give them a reason why to accept your offer that is not something to do with being jobless and all of that. Just say something like, hey, you'll get it next time. Or you listen to me moan on about my boyfriend all night, so I totally owe you.
That's nice. Should we keep it in mind when we choose the actual place to dine out?
Well, I think if you don't invite them to a Michelin-starred restaurant, just invite them to somewhere, you know, sushi, a sandwich. So just take them somewhere that they can afford. So if they really, really want to get the check or split the check, they can. Just don't take them, don't invite them to a palace of excess.
And what do you do if they refuse your offer to pay? Do you offer again?
Yeah. Offer, because nearly everyone refuses at least once, I think. And then you just offer again, I think. But if you offer twice and they refuse, then just let them split it with you. But another thing you can do if your friends are jobless and you want to have a meal with them is actually just invite them over. You know, and in a way, there's something much more comforting about being invited over to somebody's house and being given a home-cooked meal, however simple, than there is about being... Then you can avoid the whole issue of whether to treat or not to treat.
Or maybe when you're inviting someone out, say, you know, I'd really love to treat you to a meal out. Let's go to X place and just have a nice, quiet chat.
Very graceful.
Now, what about when it's time to leave the tip? Is it dismissive to say you leave the tip if you've offered the meal?
I don't like it when people do that, because if somebody leaves the tip, it means they're going to know how much the meal cost. And I feel like when you treat somebody, part of the treat is you don't have to know how much the meal costs. You don't have to worry about that at all. And then if they find out how much the meal costs and see that it's a lot, they might feel guilty. And just I feel that you can just buy. If someone says, I want to leave the tip, you just simply say, hey, you can get it next time.
Helena Eichlin is the etiquette columnist for Chow.com. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find all her columns on today's modern problems. And if you have any stories on restaurant etiquette, I hope you'll share them with all of us. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and leave a comment. Just click on latest show and scroll to the bottom. Jonathan Gold, food writer for the LA Weekly, spends most of his eating life in places that would be perfect for picking up the tab. They're inexpensive and, of course, full of flavor. When Good Food returns, we'll see where we should go this week to eat. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman, and I'll be back in 1 minute right here on Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Every once in a while, when you get a yen for something, but you're not quite sure what it is, it's always good to have Jonathan Gold around to either remind you or share something new where you've never gone before. With me this morning in the studio is Jonathan Gold, a food writer for the Los Angeles Weekly and a Pulitzer Prize winner as well. Where are we going?
We're going to Boyle Heights.
What are we having in Boyle Heights?
Mexican food. But not just Mexican food, all different kinds of Mexican food. There's always been a tradition of street vendors on the east side, usually trucks, sometimes carts. When you're lucky and you go late at night, you can see somebody with a table grilling with a big skewer of al pastor, the way that it should be with the pineapple roasting at the top. But for the last year or so, there's been a particular concentration of street vendors on near the corner of Soto and Cesar Chavez in a bank parking lot on Breed. If you go there at the right time, there's sometimes as many as 15, 20 vendors, all with different kinds of Mexican food, and it's all pretty good.
And it varies from drinks to sweet things to savory things.
Yeah, sometimes you'll have somebody selling nothing but tequino, the fermented drink that everybody loves.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. So does this occur every single night of the week, or is it just on weekends?
Pretty much every night of the week, though sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it goes very late. Sometimes it's out by 11. You never know. if you go there enough, you find the stands that you like. The Star Stand is probably the one in the middle selling Mexico City-style antojitos. You know, quesadillas, and it has sopes, and it has all those, like, fried masa snacks. And it's a really long table, and you can get your huarache fried, or you can get it griddled, and there's a really long selection of salsas to put on it afterwards. It's a delicious thing. The most unusual salsa is this one that I'd never seen before that involves, like, chopped nuts and chilies. And there's citrus in it and some other things. It's a chunky salsa. It's really good.
Wow. That sounds wonderful. I've heard there's a great pozole truck out there, too.
The pozole truck is pretty good. Even better, I think, is the barbacoa truck selling really, really soft lamb in broth, like a lamb stew with chili. There are tacos de canasta, those teeny, teeny, tiny little Mexico City-style tacos. And a cart with one of the oddest cooking methods I'd ever seen, doing tacos al vapor.
Now, what are tacos al vapor?
I've had them, but I've never seen them made. If they're always done the way that they're done here, the woman, you know, takes the tortillas and puts on basically chopped beef head. It's mostly cabeza with some lengua in there. She puts it onto this tray on top of this cart full of boiling water, and then she puts a towel over it, like a beach towel.
So she's steaming the meat.
She's steaming the meat. And I love the idea of the beach towel looking like your primary cooking implement.
Now, part of this reminds me of a Piemontese beefs in broth, beefs boiled in broth. Is it similar to that and she's just reheating it?
The meat itself isn't boiled. I mean, it seems more roasted or braised. But the tacos, instead of putting the tortillas on the grill in order to crisp them and warm them, they are steamed in order to crisp and warm them. So instead of a crisp thing, you have sort of like a melty, almost fluffy, decidedly a bit slimy taco.
Mmm, yum. Okay, I'm hungry now. So when you're down here, when you're down at this sort of Breed Street, Street Fair Fiesta that just happens, where else do you like to go?
There's a place doing a tiny little fried shrimp tacos that I think are great. There's a Guadalajara-style booth doing big bowls of steaming birria, the goat stew.
Oh.
Which may not actually be quite as good as the goat stew you can get around the corner, but it's there. There's somebody who does like really nice flautas. It depends from day to day. Sometimes there's like a clown wandering around who makes balloon animals and pesters everybody. There's something very, I don't know what the Mexican equivalent of Fellini would be. Entire families are out in the middle of summer at 11 o'clock at night, including the little kids, and everybody's running around and everybody has, or all the kids have like little toys and they're knocking soccer balls around, and there's the clown, and there's blankets of people selling bootleg DVDs of movies that won't be out for 3 weeks. And it's just a great scene.
It sounds really fun. So tell us once again where we could find this sort of spontaneous food fair.
This accumulation of food vendors is on Breed Street in East Los Angeles, just north of Cesar Chavez.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Weekly. We've got a Google map of all of Jonathan's recent restaurant selections. It's on our blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find it. I don't know if you've had a fruit cream, but I do know that you can't go one more day without one. Valerie Confections is a boutique toffee and candy company in Los Angeles. The owner, Valerie Gordon, is here tantalizing me with her latest creations using fresh farmers market ingredients. These are beautiful, Valerie. Tell me what you have here.
Well, we have a couple different things here. We have fruit creams that are a very nostalgic candy. They're really a throwback to the 1930s and sort of classic methods of candy making. And we also have some really wonderful candied citrus from our At the Market line that we're doing at the local farmers markets.
Let's turn to the candy for a minute. I have to open one up.
You really do.
And see what you mean by old-fashioned creams. Describe what this cream center is. It's amazing. It's so smooth.
Thank you. Well, I did a lot of research then about fruit creams, and I tend to draw a lot of inspiration from really old cookbooks, like 1930s cookbooks and 1940s cookbooks, because I like to go back to the heart of products, and I like to resurrect things that are somewhat extinct. So I thought, well, let's do something a little, you know, more nostalgic and kind of American in
a way.
Yeah,
I was going to say this strikes me as
very
American. Really American.
Yeah, it is. So the fruit creams, historically, like if you go back to old cookbooks, you'll find just a blend of fondant and some kind of jam or fruit extract is what was generally described as a fruit cream.
What is fondant?
Fondant is a mix of sugar, water, and glucose that is taken to softball stage, so it's really pliable. So you take it to about 238 to 240 degrees, and then you pour it out and you knead it over and over and over until it has this nice, smooth, pliable consistency that can then be dipped in chocolate. You can do all sorts of things with fondant. You see it on top of cakes a lot of the time now. It's rolled out. And you can also take it to a liquid form and dip things into fondant, like fruits. Like in a cherry cordial, you'll see a liquid form of fondant. So I kind of played with that idea a little bit. And I thought, well, how do we get a more aggressive fruit flavor into a fruit cream? Because I didn't want a shy flavor. So I'm using a bunch of different forms of fruit. I'm using fruit juice. I'm using fruit zest. I'm using fruit puree. I'm using dehydrated fruit. There's all different forms of fruit that I sort of experimented with in these fruit creams and blended it with fondant that we're making. And I put butter in almost everything that I make. So.
Yes, one can tell.
Yeah, I'm a fan of butter. So there's a lot of butter in there. I added some white chocolate, some different things to get this texture that just sort of melts on your tongue. There's a real ease to it. There's a lightness to it. It's not overly complex. Like I really wanted to make an innocent fruit candy.
Now, could the home cook make some form of these kind of creams?
Sure. Sure. You could make fondant and mix in some jam. You could also get some puree from a store like Surface and mix in some puree. And lay it out, or you can just put it into a bowl and scoop it using a melon baller and dip it into some chocolate. There's a lot of very simple ways that you can do candy making at home.
Thank you so much, Valerie.
Thank you very much.
That was Valerie Gordon from Valerie Confections. They're online and have a retail location on First near Virgil. They're also a KCRW Fringe Benefits provider, so make sure you check that out if you're a KCRW member. To see pictures of the fruit creams, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. The image of the American farmer is often a picture of a man sitting on his tractor. But more and more, there are a lot of women going into this field. I'll be back on Good Food to see if farming is women's work. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman, and you're listening to 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. According to the USDA, the number of farms has been on the decline overall, but the number of farms owned and operated by women is on the rise. Lisa Kivirist studies the economic vitality of female farmers. So, Lisa, what are the numbers?
Well, according to the last Census of Agriculture coming out of the USDA, there's been a 30% increase in women that are primary operators on farms. And this is very exciting and inspiring to see because the majority of these women are starting small-scale farms that are practicing sustainable agriculture principles. And what's interesting, too, is you see age shifts amongst farmers now. The majority of these women going into farmers are under 55, where the overall age of farmers is increasing and has been an issue as far as continuing the vitality of agriculture. So this is a very positive, vibrant trend.
What factors do you think it is that are bringing women back to the land? And are they going on their own or are they going as part of a couple?
Well, that's a good question. I think just historically, as you're well aware, women are drawn to food and are drawn to having livelihoods of meaning. And I think we'll see this even more, even during the current economic situation, of people really getting back to the root of what matters to me, and that idea of caring for the land and nurturing the landscape and creating healthy food has always been a priority of women. More women are seeing it as a lifestyle opportunity to, in some cases, go back to their family farms and recreate and reinvent them, or, as in my situation, moving to new farms entirely with no farming experience whatsoever, but a passion and a mission to make this type of lifestyle work. Some are going on their own. Some are going with partners in a marriage situation. My husband and I run the business together. You see an interesting cross-section. A friend of mine, Zoe Bradbury, up in Oregon, farms with her sister and her mother on their family farm, running three separate but independent businesses on one farm. So you see real creativity in how these businesses work.
And does it sometimes occur that the head of a farm is sort of the patriarch of the family, and then he dies, and then the wife, the widow, takes over?
You do see that. That's a big issue and a potential opportunity where you see a majority of rural landscape now being owned by senior widowed women. And there's a movement, particularly amongst the Women in Food and Agriculture Network based out of Iowa, to help these women create some plans for their land. In many cases, these women would love to have their land still farmed and ideally with organic and sustainable principles in mind, but it's almost a matchmaking type of situation to make all of this work and hook up with, in many cases, women who want to start farms and make the land management situation work out economically long term. But that's going to be an increasing issue as well.
Can you give us some examples of some really fantastic female farmers out there?
Well, sure. Let me continue on about Zoe. She is growing in Oregon, primarily for restaurants and other wholesale markets around her. But what's interesting about her, and exemplary of many women getting back into agriculture or new to agriculture, is they see this as an educational mission. So Zoe doesn't just farm. She writes for Edible Portland about her experiences as a new farmer. She's been very active in some of the new Farm Bill programs. There's a specific program, a new program, the Beginning Farmer Rancher Development Program, that has funding to help start new farms and training and low-interest loans, et cetera. So she's been championing those as well. So a lot of these women see the agriculture mission going way beyond their own acreage and extending to, as in Zoe's cases, national policy issues.
There have been some complaints that women farmers don't have a voice in government in particular. Do you find that to be true? And if so, do you think it's changing?
I definitely think it's changing. Historically, sure. Historically, women haven't had a voice in federal policy, period. But because things are increasing in number, A, the federal government's listening. The USDA is listening. They have the numbers of the 30% increase of women farmers. And B, there's more opportunity for women to voice their opinions. The Women Food and Agriculture Network I mentioned out of Iowa is helping organize women in agriculture. That umbrella is very broad in the sense of both farmers, businesses that use local foods, policy advocates, educators, writers, etc. We all have that same common goal of wanting to, in this case, increase policy that supports sustainable agriculture and women-owned enterprises. We have a story to tell, and that story goes a long way in telling what needs to happen fundamentally in our agriculture policy, our federal policy, to make some change happen.
How did you get into it? What did you do before you went onto the land?
Yeah, I was one of those people working in the corporate cubicles in Chicago, escaping to rural Wisconsin on weekends, and had no experience in this whatsoever. I grew up, my husband and I both, in about as mainstream suburban environments as you could have. But we were drawn to that lifestyle. And the more we explored it, and the more technology caught up, that you could literally work from anywhere, that's what prompted the move for us 13 years ago this year. We joke that we had the Rodale Organic Gardening Guide, a roll of quarters and a roll of duct tape to make it all work. But it's been a fabulous journey. And I really consider it a journey because it's a constant learning process. But that, I think, brings a lot of energy to anyone's life and livelihood, as well as good food for the table.
Lisa Kivarist is a Kellogg Food and Society Policy Fellow. Her work focuses on the story and economic vitality of female farmers and rural women ecopreneurs. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to learn more about Lisa and her book on this subject.
Farming is big business in the global economy, but there's a movement to downscale and eat real food grown in old-fashioned ways. This movement is called slow food. After the near collapse of our economy, some are trying to apply those principles to investing. It's called slow money. I'll be right back to find out what this concept is all about. Slow money is next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. The slow food movement is all about creating a local and sustainable food community. Can those values be applied to our economic system? Woody Tosh is the author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money.
Over the last several years, it's become increasingly obvious to anyone who's paying attention to economics that no one really knows what's going on anymore. And if you ask the experts, the investment bankers that actually engineered all of this, and the policymakers that put the pieces in place that allowed it to happen, most of them are now actually saying literally, we don't know. If you say, what's going to happen to the economy? How are we going to fix the structural problems? They basically say, we don't know. They're throwing trillions of dollars at it because that's all we actually know how to do. So that's thing one. Thing two is you started with slow food that, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, a beautiful international movement called slow food has been, let's say, coming from the ground up. And it hasn't really manifested itself fully in the U.S. yet, but it's getting there. And if you take all those things together, it just you end up with slow money.
You, in your theory, you link the base of economy to soil fertility, which I find so fascinating. Could you explain this connection between capital markets and the land?
Think about how industrial agriculture treats the soil. And how it treats the business of growing plants in the soil. It treats the soil as if it's just a place to hold plant roots so you can pour chemicals on to grow a lot of stuff. And to me, that's just like the steroid school of agriculture. I mean, we know that putting steroids in your body in order to promote, let's say, unnatural growth is unhealthy in the long term. It produces amazing results in the short term. And on a planetary level, that's what industrial agriculture has been. It's like steroids for the planetary agriculture system. So for several decades, it has produced unprecedented increases in commodity crop production using all kinds of tricks, you know, everything from chemicals to genetically modifying organisms and whatnot. But it's not healthy long term. And the most concrete and basic manifestation of that lack of health is the impact on soil fertility. People may have been lulled into a sense of security by our agriculture system because there's so much food in the stores. But every indicator, you know, soil fertility, organic matter in the soil, microorganism life in the soil, soil erosion, hundreds of millions of tons a year of soil are eroding down the Mississippi River. But probably the if you're picking one statistic about how our system has attacked or extracted the health of the soil, it would be that, you know, I would say every major monitor of world the world environmental situation agrees that somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of total arable land on the planet, 0.5% to 1% a year is being degraded. We basically have a system that is extracting fertility and I would say, now going back to the slightly metaphoric level, extracting profits out of commerce in a way which is woefully unsustainable. It's had tremendous results for 30 to 50 years, let's say. So we've all been kind of lulled into a sense that somehow we'll work our way out of it, but it is fundamentally, completely unsustainable.
Okay, now let's go to just brass tacks, if you will. Give me an idea of what a slow money approach to investing would be. What would a food project be, or a project that relates to a place, not a market, be?
Great. And that's the good news. After you get through all the bad news, they say, what the heck are we going to do? And the good news is there is, a wealth of small food enterprises kind of bubbling up all over the country. So we're talking about if there was one thing that we wanted to start talking about that was, let's say, the epitome of the direction we're moving in, I would say it's community-supported agriculture, so what's called a CSA, which is a farm that sells its produce in advance of the season to its customers. So let's say you have a CSA with 100 members. That means each member is buying 1/100th of the farm produce in advance. He or she uses it to finance their operation for the year. And then the provider of the capital gets, in this case, 1/100th of whatever the farm produces that year. It's such a simple, beautiful thing. I think what's so beautiful about CSAs is, again, what's so simple, which is it's just directly connecting a producers and consumers with no intermediation, just people going right to the source of production. And it's the ultimate in, let's say, place-based commerce. And it's where social capital, natural capital, and financial capital are all completely integrated. You can't separate them. And I believe – I'm leaping ahead here a little bit, and people are going to wonder what the heck I'm talking about here. But I believe we are going to have in the next 10 or 20 years a sea change in the way investors understand their responsibility for investing. And I think investors are going to start acting like CSA members, meaning they're going to batch together to invest in their local communities in things that they understand because they just recognize the innate value of doing so. And there aren't going to be a lot of fiduciaries around and – investment advisors and people that tell them not to do it. They're just going to do it because they know it's the right thing and they know it's necessary for our survival. So just now coming back, going back to brass tacks again, we're talking about everything here from, let's say, small diversified farms to CSAs to local processing to slow food restaurants, you know, restaurants that are committed to sourcing locally and organically, niche organic brands, you know, soil amendments, you know, various kinds of biological inputs for agriculture. There's a whole range of things that are already happening everywhere. Again, that's the good news. Great entrepreneurs building what would be considered almost micro enterprises in the U.S., meaning a small food enterprise that has sales of between, let's say, $100,000 and $1 million, just to put some numbers on it.
Talk a little bit about the idea of patient money as it relates to all of this.
Well, the last decade, up until the end of last year, I was chairman of a group called Investors Circle, which has a tagline, Patient Capital for a Sustainable Future. Investors Circle is a network of a few hundred, mostly high net worth individuals and a few small social purpose funds and foundations of various kinds that invested, let's say, $5 to $10 million a year, rough numbers, over a 17-year period in a range of companies that promoted sustainability, startup companies that promoted sustainability. And we used the term patient capital as just kind of a general descriptor that to differentiate what we were doing from traditional venture capital. Venture capital is looking for the so-called 20% annual rate of return. Patient capital, we started using the term at Investor Circle to just say, look, we want to support entrepreneurship that promotes sustainability, and we were willing to entertain the notion. I'm being very careful how I pick my words here because investors are – can be very skittish. We're willing to entertain the notion that for some portion of our venture portfolio, we might actually make a lower rate of return but still do some really good work. And if that sounds silly the way I just said it, that's just the way it is. When you get into this, the world of finance, the pull of the competitive rate of return, of being a smart investor, efficient capital markets, all of these things is incredibly strong. And without going into it further, I just say after almost 20 years, Investor Circle is still, let's say, blazing a trail for people who want to come into another space and use the power of markets, use the power of entrepreneurship, but do it in a different way. So all of that's under the general heading of patient capital.
Thank you so much, Woody.
My pleasure.
Woody Tosh is the author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money. Read more about slow money and Investor Circle at kcrw.com/goodfood. Here's a way to slow everything down. Make some pickles. I'm serious. You can pickle just about anything. So dig out those jars and lids and let's get happy. Linda Ziedrich is the author of The Joy of Pickling. I asked her what beginners should use when they first try to pickle.
I would pick beans, green beans. Some people freeze beans. Some people can beans in water. But either way, you end up with mushy beans. When you pickle them, they can turn out very crisp, and they're salty and sour, and everyone seems to love them, even children. Every child I've served them to loves pickled green beans, and they're so easy to make. All you need is vinegar, water, salt, and then you flavor them with dill and garlic and hot pepper if you like, and they're traditionally called dilly beans.
One of the things that struck me about some of the pickles in your book is that they're ethnic pickles that come from other places in the world. Pickles, of course, being a condiment that you really can find almost everywhere. And some of them that intrigued me were the eggplant pickles.
One of my favorite ways to pickle eggplant is cut up into little cubes and put into jars with vinegar. And those little cubes are lovely in a salad. You don't have to add dressing to the salad. Just add some olive oil. And it's a wonderful addition to a tossed salad.
Could you explain the difference between lactic acid pickles and pickles which are created by mostly vinegar?
There are two basic kinds of pickles, and one would be the one that's mostly vinegar. In both cases, you have acid, and acid is what preserves the produce. With lactic acid, you don't add acid. It's created. It's created through fermentation. And some people might know a lactic acid pickle as a kosher dill, for example. That's when you put vegetables into a crock with a brine, salt and water, and seasonings, and you just wait for something to happen, and little bubbles appear. And gradually, the brine will take on a delicious aroma and a tart flavor. And then the vegetables themselves will become tart and wonderful, and you have a lactic acid pickle.
Now, the pickle that I really wanted to ask you about is watermelon pickle, because I think of that as so American.
Yes, watermelons originally came from the Kalahari Desert in Africa. And the wild watermelon apparently grows in the United States, but it has a very thick rind. It has a lot of the white part. To make watermelon pickles, they're properly called watermelon rind pickles, because you could also pickle the watermelon flesh. But for watermelon rind pickles, you cut away the outer green rind, and you cut away the flesh, and you use the white part. So with these wild watermelons, you have a lot of that white part. And even with domestic watermelons, in the past, they had a thicker white part of the rind. So it made a lot of sense to use that. You wouldn't want to waste it. And even today, with such a thin white layer in our watermelons, it's still not much trouble to make those pickles, and some people just love them.
So it's pretty easy to make a watermelon pickle?
It takes a little bit of trouble to peel away the green part, and then you slice away the red, but it's really not too much trouble, and it is such a treat. And people who've never had them are just so excited about them.
The Joy of Pickling is Linda Ziedrich's book. Find a pickle recipe at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're a pickler and ever found yourself in one, tell me about it. Leave a comment on this week's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can podcast or download the show, find all past episodes and lots of great video at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can follow me on Twitter to get instant updates of my Pie a Day project. I'm at Evan Kleiman. That's Kleiman. And spend some time with your food friends on Facebook, too. Follow my fan page there. Find out about our upcoming events. Hope to see you next week at Westfield Topanga for the World's Pickiest Eater event. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Ells produced and edited this program with Bob Carlson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, Holly Tarson, and Jillian Ferguson. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.